I'm a real deal. I'll shoot your liver out and hand it to you.
We are back and just as bad as ever. Demetrius, Rob, what's up, guys?
Yeah, we're all here, boys.
Good morning, gang.
It's been a while. It has been a long while.
What, like 3 weeks?
Yeah, it's been something like that. It's been a good while. But we've
I
been doing
like
lots
I've
of
been
fun
in
things.
Quarantine.
We've been doing some fun things, I think. So anybody who doesn't have a Facebook account, the reason we've been gone for so long was we actually did a Facebook matchup, and that was against Team Europe. So we actually put together a Team USA, and we played a Moscone Cup-styled event against Team Europe. So that is why we've been gone. We've been putting a ton of time and effort into creating that, and I will be uploading this to YouTube as well very, very soon. So if you wanted to watch it, you can. But we've been putting a ton of time into this, and we just didn't really have any time to sit down and do a podcast together. So now we do, and here we are.
Yeah, I'll just throw my two cents in about watching it. I would recommend watching it for just like a thousand reasons. I put my time in viewing at least 60% of it, and it was worth 100%. That 60%. And the reason I say this is there are many reasons. One of the primary ones is that it's a perfect example of watching excellent pool, but not so excellent that it's perfect. And that in itself is a payday, a great big payday for any amateurs out there who take a look at this, because it's not like the two best players in the world head-to-head that are never going to make a mistake. And that, in a low, if that teaches you while you watch it. Yeah, for that one reason. There's many more, but that's the first one I'm going to mention.
Yeah, and we will chat about it. We'll probably – there hasn't been a ton going on, but that'll be one of the things we actually talk about as far as that. So we can get to that in a little bit, I guess. I guess – for anybody who this may be your first introduction to the podcast, maybe you joined from, you know, just looking, seeking out stuff from this COVID situation. You're looking for some more pool content, or maybe you made your way over here from this streaming event. Maybe you heard about us for the first time there. This is a pool podcast that we talk about everything that goes on in the world of pool. So, you know, what happened the week prior, what's coming up in the week to come. It's a little bit weird in this time because a lot of the stuff that's happening, it's kind of spur of the moment. And, you know, we don't really have a huge heads up for it. But, you know, there's a couple of big events that we can still talk about, and we will talk about one of them. But we basically keep you up to date with everything that's going on in the world of pool as best we can from our U.S., I guess, filter, because we see a lot of the things that happen in the U.S. and the bigger events that happen in the world, but we don't cover stuff like the Euro Tour or anything like that. Mostly just, you know, world events from the filter of a U.S. fan. So that's a little bit about what we do here. And then we also have interviews with players and promoters and all that good stuff throughout the events. And yeah, give it a try, see if you like it. And, you know, we try to make 2 to 3 episodes a week, although of course, we've struggled a little bit recently because of the event that we put on. But yeah, we try to have plenty of events and or plenty of podcasts and plenty of content out there to keep your pool engagement as high as it can be, especially during these kind of weird times. So to get all the things cleared up in the beginning, there isn't much, but there are 2 new podcasts out there, pool podcasts. And one of them is a Wisconsin one, so I will give a plug to this. Anybody who is looking for more pool content, check out Chalk is Cheap. It is a self-described Twin Ports pool podcast, so it's mostly Superior and Duluth, but the stories that they tell on it transcend the game of pool. It's basically, you know, they talk about what's going on in the area as far as some of the content, but I mean, there's nothing going on because everything's shut down. So it's mostly just they bring on a guest each week and they talk about stories. And some of them are really, really interesting. So I won't play spoiler to any of those, but they have 5 episodes out now. And I've listened to all of them. I actually listened to the first 3 episodes in one sitting, which took a while. But it's a pretty good podcast. And it's definitely worth giving a listen to just for the stories. The stories are definitely interesting. You know, as I guess, kind of historical documents, I guess, maybe. So,
well, there's going to get to be more of that. I'm from the Twin Ports, and the history of it and the uniqueness of a lot of the players that are going to be on this podcast it's worth a listen. They're going to be fun, interesting stories, and by and large, mostly true.
Rob hasn't been on it yet, so there hasn't been any fabrications yet.
No. Yeah, I was up to Duluth Superior until I was around 27, 28, and then I moved away. But until then, yeah, there's a lot of stories in the Twin Ports, cool stories. And that the infamous Williams brothers. Williams are from Duluth, and everybody in the Twin Cities knows who they are.
Yeah, and you your name has been mentioned a couple times on the stories that have happened on those podcasts, so Rob's a local celebrity there. He doesn't know because he doesn't listen to any podcasts, including our own, but that's okay. So, yeah, just know that that's out there. And there is also a new podcast out now from Matchroom. So I don't know how, I guess, frequent they're going to be doing it. I don't know who's actually even the host for it or anything like that. I know that the first episode and the only episode that they had out was with Carl Boyce, and they brought on Jason Shaw. It had Mike Pinoza on there, and it had Emily Frazier on there. So I'm not totally sure what the direction of that looks like, but it's called Loose Pool, and it can be found basically everywhere that you can find a podcast. So you can head over there and listen to that podcast as well if you're looking for some more pool content. But other than that, the only other thing that I have to get cleared up is I made another post on the Facebook page for people to come to the Moscone Cup if they would like. And we basically have, I think about 9 people now that are confirmed to go. So we're going to have our own little section of the audience that are the queued up people. And Jennifer Bretta even actually committed to going, so she will be sitting with us as well, if that's not motivation enough for you. But if you're interested in going to the Moscone Cup and you would like to sit in our group with us, feel free to reach out to me me or the podcast at any point in time, and we'll get you all the information that you need for it. But I would say if you're interested in going and you just want some more information on it, the internet is a really good resource for it. You know, so I'm not going to look up your flights. I'm not going to look up your hotel for you. A lot of people have been asking me basically what the info on that is. Just look for it. I mean, there's this thing called Orbitz or Google. I promise you it has your answers. I don't want to have to look up everybody's information. So we can move on from there to the actual podcast itself. So this is the segment where we talk about what had happened previously, and we can talk a little bit about the event that we did. So this was, like I said in the beginning, a Moscone Cup styled event, meaning basically we ripped off their format with a couple of small tweaks, and it was the U.S. versus Europe. I formed the U.S. team, and Jim Telfer formed the Europe team. So on Team USA, I had my great friend now, Demetrius Gelatis, who was the only player who played well. So good job, Demetrius. We also had we also had Rob Saez, Jennifer Beretta, John Demet, and myself. So that was Team USA. Team Europe was Henrique Correa, Darren Appleton, Jim Telfer, Margaret Fefalova, who I still think hasn't missed a ball since the start of that event, and Maximiliano Corso. So if you haven't heard any of those names, you're going to probably want to, because they're all play really, really good. You're going to be seeing especially a lot of Max in the future, I think. But So yeah, we kind of created a Moscone Cup styled event. We got kind of our butts kicked. I'm not even actually sure what the final score was. It like 17-4 or something like that. Does that sound right, Demetrius?
Well, I mean, it was 11-2 it was a race to 11 and we got beat 11-2, and then we played out the remaining matches as kind of a speed run exhibition. And so I think we won two of those out of five. So it was probably 14-4, final score, but I guess in my mind, it was kind of 11-2.
Yeah. And, the U.S. side, I don't think we didn't really put up much of a fight. I don't think Rob had been playing much. I definitely played terrible as far as jumping back and forth. Demetrius, you played pretty well for the most part. I mean, you kind of described yours as like the high end of your worst game, the way that you played.
It was a tough situation, yeah. So.
Yeah, and I know the first day you had to play partially in the dark, which didn't help any.
Yeah, it was dicey. But, you know, I mean, you know what? I'm not going to pretend like, I was effective in the sense that I got the job done at times, but it did. I definitely never felt comfortable. I never flowed. I never played with any confidence. It was kind of a grind. You know what I mean? Like, so that's why I say it was kind of the best of my worst game. I'm not going to be like, oh, that's the worst I've ever played, because there's days when I play bad and then I'm not effective. And so at least I was able to get through some racks, but holy smokes, there was a lot of things that made that tough.
But I mean, there was a lot of really important points that we could have won to make it pretty close. I know that Jennifer and I, we actually were on the hill with, I think, a 4-2 lead, and we just could not get the breaks to, you know, it's a unique format where it's, you break the balls, and basically the break at that point in time tells you whether or not you're going to run out. The play is at a high enough level between everybody, maybe short of myself, where there's not going to be a lot of mistakes that are going to be made. It's mostly just whether or not the run out is there. You know, you have balls close to each other, or, you know, just not traveling back and forth on the table a lot. You know, you don't have balls tied up, stuff like that. Maybe you make a ball or two, but really the break, I think, is the decider on whether or not you even run out of rack. And you could definitely tell that Team Europe plays this format a lot more than we do. We were not breaking the balls as well as they were.
Yeah, I mean, it was very clear, and that's an insurmountable edge. So the part that I can agree with is that, I mean, Europe has been playing nine ball racked on the spot, you know, break off the rail, 3-point rule. Of course, we weren't enforcing the 3-point rule, but just because of lack of referees and all that. But the bottom line is, I mean, they've been playing like that for longer than the U.S. players. But what I would also say, though, is that we have been playing like that for, I mean, there's been more and more tournaments over the last few years that have gone to nine ball, the spot, break from the side rail. And I mean, I knew that was going to be critical. So one thing that helped me maybe do a little bit better than some of the other players on the team, or maybe whatever, is that I really put in a lot of work on my break, the week before this event, because what actually happened is I was watching April Larson and Pia Filler, and I watched that match, and I watched the first eight games. I think April, I might be off, but I think April was down 7-1 against the Ghost, and Pia was up 7-1 against the Ghost. And I was watching how Pia was breaking and making two balls and spreading everything open with no clusters. And I was watching how April was smashing into the balls, making 0-1 balls. Stuff was laying with really funny transitions and clusters. And I was watching this, and I just got this queasy feeling in my gut. And I'm like, I don't care how good I can play on my best days. I can't give up that kind of an advantage and expect to do well. And especially it would be one thing if I was playing somebody, where they're rated, 100 Fargo points lower than me, and I've got such a big skill edge that I can outrun that. But I'm going to be playing against Darren Appleton. I'm going to be playing against some European champions here that just play really, really well. Like, I can't – I realize that break is worth at least 100 Fargo points. I mean, at least. If you break and spread the balls open and make two balls in the break, I would rather have a 625 Fargo attempt to run a 7-ball run with open balls as opposed to a 725 Fargo trying to run a 9-ball run with clusters. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that – so you put a lot of work into your break the week before. I actually picked up my pool cue once the week before, and that was mostly because I was planning and coordinating and trying to get a lot of the templates in place for the event, getting last second things done. I actually went into this pretty unprepared. I learned how to break the night before, and that was from watching some Derby City matchups with Tyler Steyer playing basically in the Derby City. And what I didn't realize until day three of when I actually talked to Tyler, that Derby City, you actually have to break from the box. So I'm breaking from the box where Tyler was, and he was doing that because he had no other choice but to do that. So on day three, Tyler's like, "You're an idiot. Break from the side rail." I didn't have that chance. So
right. And actually, it's a good thing for players that are starting to venture out into pro tournaments. This may be a minority, but for people that want to go to Derby or for people that want to go to some bigger tournaments, the Turning Stone or whatever, what I've done for myself is I have a piece of paper that has a 2x2 grid, and the grid goes 9 ball on the spot, 9 ball, 1 ball on the spot. And then, so it's either the 9 ball on the spot or the 1 ball on the spot. And then it's either break from the box or it's break from anywhere on the kitchen. And so basically those are the variants. If you're not playing 10 ball, those are the variants that you might run into. You might run into 1 ball on the spot, break from anywhere. You might run into 9 ball on the spot, break from the box. And so I have notes on how I break on each one of those four, because it's almost like four different shots. And so, yeah, you were practicing shot three, break from the box, 9 ball on the spot, and you needed to be practicing break four. So anyway, but there's a couple sayings about preparation. There's two sayings that I think of all the quotes, and one of them that I've always known is the game is won before it's played. And I like that. It's like people that show up and hope to play well and hope to win and just like, let's see how it goes. So let's see if we can get it done. Like, I really like the idea that you win the game before you play it. Like, either you've prepared so that you are ready to go deliver the performance you need to deliver, or you're showing up and hoping it comes together. And it's like, that's a saying I've always liked, is that the game is won before it's played. But then the other one that I actually, Bo Runnigan told me this quote, and it gave me chills. And so I'll share it. It says, you don't rise to the level of your dreams. You sink to the level of your preparation. And that one always,
hurts.
It just gave me, what's that?
That strikes deep. That hurts.
Oh, yeah. So it's like, but it's true. It's like, people think that they're just going to they have this idea of what they want to have happen and they think they're just going to float to it. But it's like, no, you will fall from your dreams. You will fall and crash to the level that you've built your preparation. And so anyway, those are the things I think that. And so I'm not picking on anybody. I'm just saying this is for people that watched and want to take something away, that what we need to look at is not what happened on the screen, because what happened on the screen was like the tip of the iceberg. That's just the culmination of the preparation or lack of preparation that went in, and the break was a big part of it. But I also don't want to say it's everything, because I don't want to diminish the play of the European players. They played and converted on their opportunities tremendously. But the break is definitely a double whammy, because not only are we getting more difficult layouts, but then as a result of that, we're behind on score. Our success rate of running out is lower. And so now, when you're getting beat in the sets and you're down on set count and you're behind during the sets and you feel like they're getting easy layouts and not making mistakes and you're having to make tougher layouts, then not only are you coming to the table with a physically more difficult rack to run, but you've got all that. You're up against it, and you know you're up against it. And if any of you guys listening have ever played a match where you're coming up dry on the break and the other person's raining balls in on the break and you're playing alternate the break and they just keep running every rack and you keep coming up dry and hoping they make a mistake to let you to the table, you know how discouraging that feels. Well, that was kind of how so it all snowballs. It starts with physically being more difficult opportunities, and then it snowballs into just this feeling of like, how are we going to play out of this spot, And yeah. So the break – And the preparation of the break was definitely a big takeaway.
Yeah, for sure. So that's a little bit about the event, and I guess Demetrius and I's takeaway from it. It's a little bit unique, maybe being the people that are actually playing in it for once, as opposed to just talking about other people. But Rob, you have the unique ability of kind of watching this as well with us being involved in it. So I think I'd be interested to see what your takeaways for the events were, and basically, I guess, your thoughts on it.
Well, I have a lot of thoughts on it. I have a lot of positive thoughts on it, I'll tell you that. It was probably the most enjoyable pool I've watched, possibly in my whole life. I don't watch a lot of pool. And I already said one reason is because of, after 60 years of watching people put balls in holes, it's old hat. You watch them do it, they're going to succeed. They're perfect players. But this type of format, getting these people from different places in the world to play at the same time live was the greatest thing so far. I mean, there was no tape delays. There was, after the preliminary dry runs, would you have a day of dry runs or 2 days of dry runs in eight? Before it actually got streamed?
Yeah, we had, what did we do? We did two testing runs. Is that right, Demetrius? Or we do three?
Well, I know that, I think that we did a couple rounds because the testing run that I was on, we had half the players. You might have done two or three rounds. I just know that I was involved in one of them. So yeah.
Yeah, I think we did three runs, and we are really, really lucky that none of those three runs were, the final product, because that would have just been terrible. I mean, the first three runs were completely unviewable. They were awful.
Yeah. And to see the level of caring involved. You see, these guys, these professional players over there, they're not playing for a lot of money here. They're not traveling all over the world, and they got a lot invested in this. But you know what they had invested? Every one of the players who played, all 10 of these players, they had their souls and their reputations invested in this. And that's almost harder to manage than it is a few hundred bucks or a few thousand bucks. You got, you go to a pool tournament, spend a couple grand, and you go, big deal. Because really, that's the only thing on the line. Anybody in the tournament, they don't know you. They don't know who you are. You have no reputation on the line to uphold. But this is being streamed all over the Facebook world. And these are professional players, except for you. You're the only amateur. Is that correct?
I guess it depends on what you consider an amateur. But yeah, I guess maybe. John, I mean, I know. John plays pretty professionally. Demetrius, I don't think you would consider yourself a professional. But I mean, you can.
Like you said, that the word itself doesn't have a lot of meaning today.
Right. Well, he's over 650, so how much of an amateur is he? Not much. I mean, he's pretty darn good. So. When you look at Jennifer, was just, 20 points higher on the Fargo than you. You're right about that. But anyways, we'll put it into perspective. You were the lowest rated Fargo rate?
No, actually, Max on the European side, I think he had a 655, and I think I'm a 658 or something like that. So he's just a little bit below me, but I don't think his Fargo's not accurate. I mean, I don't think mine is either.
I think this question is asking.
That's a good amateur. That's a quality amateur, correct?
Yeah, that's a state master level player.
Yeah. Right.
And Rob, this question was asked on AZ Billiards like a month ago, and people were talking about what the cutoff is for professional. And after five pages of debate, I said that I know the answer to this is that the actual cutoff of what a professional, what an amateur is in pool, is exactly my level of skill, and that everyone worse than me is an amateur and everyone better than me is a professional. And I'm trying to decide if I want to be the greatest amateur in the world, but I think I've opted to be, I am actually the worst professional player who has ever picked up a pool cue. That's what I mean.
I'm actually, yeah. I feel the same way with
Nate's
like a state. Yeah, Nate, I'm the worst master
was
that ever.
The worst double A that ever played.
I was the worst double A in the state of Wisconsin, and then I got promoted to a master, and now I'm the worst master in the state of Wisconsin. It's an exciting thing to be, Demetrius.
I'll fight you for that, Nate, because I actually think I am.
Okay, well, how's this? I tell this to anybody who wants to. Whoever wants to challenge me for the title, you can have 9 games of 10 and all the breaks, and we'll play for the worst master in the state. Loser gets the title. Well, how's that sound?
I'm starting to cut out a little bit again here. So,
and I have one other thing I'd like to mention about that match, if I can jump in.
Sure.
the big thing that I think I've really been paying attention to is the, I really saw if Europe did outperform the U.S. players, it was partly the break, partly the snowball effect. I mean, I really started to become aware of how important every rack and every point is, because one rack leads to one match, leads to a score deficit, which leads to momentum and all these things. I mean, it was amazing how quickly this thing got away from us, you know. But in any case, I would say their pattern play. I've been watching the patterns. You know, I watched Pia Filler, and I watched how she performed against the Ghost compared to April Larson. And I watched these European players run out, you know, Margaret running out, you know, five racks in a row in that one set and having like a streak of 7-8 racks. And I'm watching that. And they really play superior patterns than we did. They really played superior patterns. And so this is tough to talk about without, you know, stuff in front of me that I can, you know, kind of drill down and show specific differences or examples. But when I watched the U.S. players, it was, you know, landing flat and having to pound balls in and then elevated off rails and spearing down on stuff and then recovery shots and just kind of like it was and partly because of the break, but partly just because it didn't look as tight. Whereas the European players, you know, they're just kind of floating their cue ball a couple feet, keep it on the right side of the ball, you know, relying a little bit on some clean ball pocketing, minimal cue ball movement, and just, you know, it was really, really superior. And so
I totally agree.
And so I'm a big, I took some things away that I learned. And in particular, I don't know, again, if I had a table and if I could really set up examples, partly I would say that I have learned that they accept that, you know, I talk about how pattern play, cue ball control, and shot making are like three skills to intertwine towards running out. And that, you know, when you play good cue ball, it takes pressure off your shot making. And when you can shoot straight, you can take a little pressure off your pattern play because you can accept a little bit more shot making, you know, and to keep the patterns and decisions simpler. And when you choose simpler patterns, it takes pressure off your cue ball because you're not having to execute so much. And what I would say is that they took on a little bit more on the shot making side to really reduce, to simplify their patterns and simplify their cue ball so that they took a lot of pressure off. And then as a result, maybe they would accept a little bit more on the shot making side. But then what they would do is they would not be spinning balls with inside English multiple rails and all this stuff. They would really, really keep it foolproof. And one example I can give without a pool table, if you rack the nine on the spot, there's a situation that comes up a lot where you've got a shot, your eight balls, you're shooting the eight ball in the side pocket, and you're a little bit on the wrong side of the eight ball. So you can either cinch the eight, roll it in, and accept a shot from, you know, the outside of the, you know, the wrong half of the table, kind of, and cutting the spot shot in from, you know, approaching the kitchen line. Or you can zip the cue ball around the table three rails, you know, to try to get closer to the nine again. And the way that these guys were playing is they would just, you know, more and more often they would just roll the ball in and take a little bit longer shot as opposed to moving the cue ball around a lot. And so that's more of a hypothetical. That's just one thing I could describe. And so I've been really studying, and for I wanted to give the viewer or the listeners here something that they could go and refer to. There's a match that I watched the other day with a student of mine, and this match is between Ralph Soquet and Carl Boyes in the World Pool Masters 2018. So if you YouTube Ralph Soquet, Carl Boyes, this little match will pop. And if you watch, Ralph goes from 0-0 to 4-0. He runs four racks with ball in hand. He runs out and breaks and runs three, I think. And if you watch what he does, he refuses to do anything difficult. Like, he flat out refuses to do anything difficult. And he finds a way to play the right angles to keep the shot simple. I mean, there are some things in this run, guys. I want everybody here to go watch this four rack run, because there are times when he has a long straight shot and he can stop and have a really long next shot with the right angle, or he could draw back 2 feet to get closer. And he shoots the stop shot, because if he draws back, he might draw back along slightly the wrong and go offline and not have the ideal angle for the next shot. And he has stuff where he had a six ball where he has a choice between drawing back, spinning the cue ball, or force following with inside. And he just shoots a stop shot and banks the eight. And it's like, I would have been for sure using high inside or low outside, and I would have been making that shot really, really different. And so anyway, watch this. I'm kind of getting on the verge of where people might not be following me, so I'll just bring it back and say this. At no point, whenever the situation seemed to demand something difficult, Ralph just was stubbornly refusing to do anything difficult, and he just said, basically, he just said no. And here's a guy that dominated pool for 15, 20 years, was at the highest levels, and still nearly is, without ever doing anything hard. You can watch him play, count how many times you say, wow, what a shot. I mean, almost exclusively, it's just really, really keeping it simple and refusing to be bullied into thinking he needs to do something tough. And when the situation is demanding and difficult, he just says, well, I'll find something simple to do then. And it reminds me of like how Buddy Hall played. And so anyway, that seems to be how the European players play. I think that's so important. When we grew up playing, there's this idea that we want to learn how to do all these hard things consistently. And people wonder why they struggle with consistency, and they keep trying to master difficult shots and difficult cue ball control. And it's like, no, the only way to consistency is to find a way to run tables using shots that you can execute 99% of the time. That's really the key to this game. And I think the European players really demonstrated how that can look.
I agree with that.
I took away the story that if you're on a 9 foot table, if you're 3 feet away from the object ball versus 8 feet away from the object ball, and all you want to do is draw it back 3 inches straight back and 2 inches to the left, your chances of success if you're 8 feet away are slim and none to executing that position shot. If you're 3 feet away, if you're a 700, you're going to do it. You're going to do it a lot. And that's what I saw. I just saw, generally speaking, the European players always a little bit closer to their object ball.
And a lot of that was probably playing the right patterns from start to finish, so that, you know, and I was guilty of this a lot.
There's no question.
Yeah, I was guilty of this a lot. If anybody ever watched my games, I play 2 to 3 shots of, you know, good positioning, and then I would get myself into this battle where each time I would still make the balls, but I would get a little bit more out of line, a little bit more out of line, a little bit more out of line, until the point where I'm now at the point where I can miss any ball that I'm shooting at because the difficulty is so high, and I can't do a lot with the cue ball for any of these shots either, because, you know, the pot is so hard on the ball. So I'd get deep into these racks, and sometimes I just miss stupid balls. Like I missed a couple 9 balls that I still am scratching my head about, but you know, it was usually a missed 7 ball or a missed 8 ball because I just played so many poor positionings along the way that I just keep getting into this rut that I couldn't get out of. And a lot of it is probably because, one, I wasn't playing a lot, so my speed wasn't exactly great. And then, you know, part of it is I'm a bar box player. I mean, that's just what we have available to us in the state of Wisconsin. And you got to play different positionings. You got to use, you know, a little bit more rails, use natural lines.
You do.
You can't just kind of draw and cinch balls all the way over the place like you can on big tables. Big tables is a lot of just using natural angles and just allowing the cue ball to flow freely, where I think the bar box is a little bit more, you know, using a little bit of extreme low, extreme high, stuff like that, just to cinch balls or move balls over a little bit because the shots aren't hard. So, you know, you can easily make balls on a bar box.
It really changes the percentages. I've had a couple students where they send me videos where I've actually had a chance to play them in a tournament on a bar table. And when I watched them play at a bar table, it's harder, and I'm pretty good at clocking games, but it's harder to identify the leaks in their game. But I know that if I move them to a 9 foot diamond, that I will, it just magnifies all the leaks. And so when you're used to playing on bar tables, the penalty you pay for getting a little long or a little flat angled or a little bit on the wrong side of the ball, or, you know, the penalties you pay are lower because you can recover so much easier. And when you, so if you're playing 9 ball where your patterns are a little loose and you're getting, you know, having to bomb in a series of recovery shots or getting to where, you know, it's just not quite as natural, you can kind of just get into a rhythm and get through it. But when you're playing on a 9 foot diamond, you can get through some racks, but the penalty, it takes a toll a lot quicker. That's all.
Yeah. And the racks that I got out of, I basically just overpowered them. I mean, if that makes sense. I mean, I didn't run out of them.
Oh, yeah.
Europe, they basically just, they just smoothed through the entire rack, and I would overpower racks. I'd usually stroke 3 to 5 balls at a really high level, and I just really relied on, my shot-making abilities to overpower a lot of these racks. I did not make them look very smooth at all.
And another comment made the difference in the tables. And the table that you were playing, your particular table, I have played on it. And that's one of the tightest 9-foot diamonds I've ever played on.
Yeah, I didn't realize that when I was playing on it, that it was actually shimmed. It was a shimmed pro cut pocket. So I think it was like 5.1 or 4.1, I think is what it was. I didn't realize it until afterwards, but. You hit the center of the pocket, you don't have to worry about it, right?
I played a game of straight pool on it against a guy there the last time I was there. I never ran over 9 balls. I bobbled the 10th ball every time. Yeah. Tough.
Well, I think that gives us a pretty good discussion about the match. Probably longer than it should have been, but I don't know. I had fun with it. And I think Rob, you had fun watching. I think Demetrius, you had fun playing in it, so why not?
Oh,
we can give a little extra time.
I had a ball watching it. Seriously.
And that's saying something.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. It bores me. Even 3 cushion kind of bores me watching it.
Yeah.
Doesn't bore me playing it.
So there's a lot of other events that have happened, smaller stuff. Like Demetrius had hinted about Pia and April Larson playing. That can be found at Roy's Basement on their Facebook page. And he has, of course, a couple of other matches. He has a match going on right now between Joshua Filler playing the 12-ball ghost and Anton Raga, I think. Is that how you pronounce his last name, Raga? Does anybody know?
I'm not sure, but it seems like it.
Okay. So, Raga is an up-and-coming player from the Philippines. He's like the next big thing. He's like the next big Filipino, basically. And they're playing the 12-ball ghost right now. And, I mean, Joshua Filler is just so – he's such a – it's stupid watching him play. He makes it look so easy, and he's kind of running away with his match. He beat the ghost like 21 to 9 the first set, and like 21-6 or something stupid like that the second set. So they're still playing their matches today. By the time that you hear this, it won't, because I'm actually in finals week right now for my schooling. So my last final is going to be on Wednesday, and this is currently Tuesday morning. So we're going to record this right now. I am not going to be editing this and getting it out before my final. This is just, this is the way it goes. So,
what's the name of the class your final is in?
I don't even know what the name of it is. CS 354 is the next final, or the last final I have. Computer science 350. I don't even know what the name of the class is, to be honest. I gotta look.
Well, let's hope that's not a question on the final exam then.
Yeah, I hope not. Machine organization and programming.
Oh, yeah, let's keep it simple.
Yeah, so we can move on now to, I guess, the next big event we get to look forward to. The next big one we get to look forward to is a matchup between Joshua Filler and Justin Bergman. And this is actually going to be a real, quote-unquote, event, pre-COVID real match. They're going to be playing in Louisville somewhere. I'm not exactly sure. It's Louisville Private Club. So somewhere in there. And it's going to be the 15th through the 17th. So it's a little ways away still. But it is an 8-ball race to 80 with $40,000 in the middle. They're playing on a Diamond Pro-Am 9-footer. So 8-ball on the big tables. And I don't know all of the rest of the details before this. And that will actually be really, really pivotal for my prediction on this match, but we'll talk about it. I guess it probably won't be take what you make, or I feel like that would be part of the actual flyer, because that's a huge, huge, huge difference between take what you make and just run out, just regular whatever BCAPL rules or whatever you want to play by. There is a big difference between that. I would not want to be playing Joshua Filler in any game right now. Except
and it's going to be winter breaks, correct?
Yeah, winter break. Yep. So
yeah. Okay.
So we can talk about this. I'll say this. If this is take what you make or take what you make the most of, more specifically, I do not think that this is anywhere close to the blowout that people are predicting it being. You know, I've seen people giving as many as 10 games on the wire to Justin Bergman. If this is take what you make the most of, this is like the first time in a long time where I've actually thought it's a coin flip. Justin Bergman, I mean, you really, really have to play some really tight patterns, big table, pro cut, eight ball, take what you make the most of. You got to play some really tight patterns and, you know, to really put some packages together. And I know that Justin Bergman can do that because I've seen him do that several times. I don't know that Joshua Filler can do that. He's not an eight ball player by nature. Europeans tend not to be. And I really think that this could be a situation where the break is no longer as big of a deal. It's because, you know, if you make three stripes and, you know, one solid and you have to take stripes and you have, you know, three stripes that are tied up with each other, well, the break did you no good. So there's a lot of situations. I mean, it's going to be hard to tell to see what the break, the table's breaking like. But I think if it's take what you make the most of, it's a huge neutralizer. And I may even take Justin Bergman. I'd have to think about it a little bit longer, which we'll have some time to do. But if it's just straight up take what you make, or if it's just straight up BCA rules, Joshua Filler, I think he's playing so good. I don't think he can lose that from there. What do you guys think? Rob, you want to
go ahead, Demi.
Oh, Demetrius?
Well, yeah, I'm gonna go way out on a limb and take Josh Filler. And let me tell you, of course, we've talked about this a little bit that the more the break gets neutralized and the more that the after the break game is emphasized. You know, if it's take what you make the most of, and if the balls aren't breaking well and they've got super tricked out pockets like he played John Mora on, then those are things that are gonna make Justin, you know, very competitive, because in those environments, it's not like a momentum runaway train game. It's a who can, you know, nobody ever gets in stroke. And like the Mora match where it's like nobody ever gets to run racks and nobody's ever in stroke. And we're just fighting and clawing and grappling for opportunities. And it's you know, in a game like that, you know, Justin Bergman can scrap with the best of them, no doubt. But I don't think that the break is going to get neutralized enough for that playing big table eight ball, even if it's take what you make the most of. I just don't see slowing Filler down enough. And here's what I think that it's easy to forget. It's easy to forget that Josh Filler is one of the best bankers in the world. And when you're playing big table eight ball, banking balls, even though you play patterns to avoid banking balls, and if you're playing well, you don't have to do it very often, banking balls is a critical skill. It's easy to forget that he's run 285 balls in straight pool before he was 18. And for people that don't think that he can play eight ball, let me tell you something about running 285 balls in straight pool. You can run eight balls of eight ball. Like, it's just, obviously it's a little different game and you can sit here and talk about percentages, but I've one of the things that I've been most amazed by watching, they had a few of these tournaments over the last 3-4 years, races to 15 on bar tables, take what you make the most of. And I was blown away watching these tournaments at how little safety play there was. When I heard that it was take what you make the most of race to 15, I thought that there'd be like a lot of safety battles going down. And I watched a match with, you know, I don't remember, Shane and Alex, where there might've been one safety in the entire race to 15. They were taking this game that I thought was going to be defensive nature, and they were playing absolutely run out pool. And so I think that this whole idea that this is going to be a lot of, you know, moving and cagey and Justin's going to have a lot of, like, you know, street fight moves. Like, I don't see it, man. I believe that at the highest level, eight ball is a runout game. And if you magnify that and go onto a 9-foot table, it's a runout game even more, as long as you have the shot making to put the balls down at a 9-foot table. And Filler absolutely does. So here's a guy that has a great break, that has absolutely is not going to miss many balls, that can bank well, that can run racks, and that can play, you know, can put hundreds of balls together playing straight pool, and that is absolutely on fire. I think he can make this a break and run contest. I think he can make this an overpower contest. And as good as Justin moves and as well as he plays after the break, I just don't see it, guys. I don't see it. I'm going to take Filler.
Yeah, I agree. I'll take Filler. He's putting balls in the pockets as good as anybody right now. Solid. You can tell by the sound. The ball hisses across the cloth. It slaps the back center of the pocket. I just got to love that when I hear that. It's like Margaret. That's how she played in the stream when she shot the ball in. They were going in the center of the hole. And I like it. I like Filler all the way. He's pocketing skills, best in the world right now, I think. I really do.
Yeah, I definitely don't disagree with that. And we get to see Joshua Filler play all day, every day, because he's always on the stream with Roy doing something. We haven't been able to see Justin Bergman play much. That could mean one of two things. Either, he's just not playing, or he's just not streaming his matches. Well, he's a pretty low-key, kind of quiet pro anyway, so I can't imagine he would be streaming a lot of his stuff regardless. If he actually is playing, and playing a lot, I think that this match can be close. I do think that Justin Bergman has the cue power to stay with Joshua Filler, unlike many of the people, in the world. If he's not playing, I agree with Demetrius. This probably is going to be a runaway, and that's just because Joshua Filler's in dead stroke. He's always playing. You got to be prepared. And what was the Bo Runnigan? It's not about how high your dreams are. It's about bringing you down to where your preparation has gotten you. Something like in so many words. If Justin's not prepared, he's definitely going to be in some trouble for this match. But.
Well, I think that this I'll say this. I think that this is a better matchup than him than Filler and Aranis, because with Filler and Aranis, as well as Aranis plays 10 ball, there was not any part of that fight where he had an edge. And so it's almost like if some kind of and I don't match up UFC or MMA, but if somebody's got the better grappling, the better striking, the better reach, the better strength, it's like where's their edge? And as good as Aranis plays, Aranis might be one of the top 5 or 10, maybe top 10 in the world playing 10 ball for money, but he didn't have a single area of the game he had an edge.
I think the analogy for it, if you don't mind me, it's like Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant. Like Kobe Bryant is basically Michael Jordan Jr., but Michael Jordan was better at everything. They're almost the same player, but Michael Jordan was better at everything. I think that's a pretty good analogy for it.
That's exactly right. Whereas with Bergman, even though I think that Filler's going to come out on top, at least there are parts of the game that Bergman can be, at least he can fall back and say, well, I am, I'm going to make less careless mistakes, or I'm going to play better 8-ball patterns, or I'm going to be prepared to outmove him in safety battles. I don't know that those edges that he has are going to be enough, but at least he could point to something. I'd rather see a guy at a disadvantage in terms of breaking and striking and at least have some counterplay. In chess, they call it counterplay. It's like you've got the less material, you're in a worse position, but at least you've got, activity and control of the e-file with your rooks or something, but whereas there's times in chess when you're just down material or down positionally and you have no counterplay. At least Justin's got some counterplay here.
Yep. Yeah, I think so. If it slows down and turns into a slugfest, Justin Bergman is the favorite in that style of game for sure, I think. If it turns into a runout pool, it could be an 80-40 kind of match. I mean, Joshua Filler, you don't want to try to turn this into a runout fest for sure.
I said I like the choice of 8-ball versus rotation games.
Oh yeah, I agree.
For the viewing audience and what they're going to learn from that.
Yeah, I think so. It's nice to see these top players playing 8-ball. It's more relatable to the players, for sure. So I guess that kind of wraps up our discussion. This isn't for another 10 days, so we'll actually get another podcast out from now. Until then, we'll maybe go into next week a little bit more of the intricate details of the match, and maybe we'll know a little bit more by then, so we can talk more about the actual rules that they're going to be playing by. But I think we got a pretty good discussion out there about how we're looking at this match. So we can move on to the end of the podcast.
Okay, well, here I got one for you. What do you call a dog that does magic tricks?
I got nothing.
A Labracadabrador.
Oh, that's terrible. Demetrius, I think we're about to get swarmed with dad jokes.
Yeah, that's usually a sign the party's over.
I'm in Superior. Yeah, I drove from Hayward to Superior during the podcast.
Yeah, Rob, you're picking up a new pool table today. You found one online and stole
it. I'm picking up a 1958 vintage Brunswick 10-foot billiard table today for the amazing price of $300.
Yeah, he stole it.
Yeah. If anybody out there in the listening land wants to purchase some pool products or tables or need some restored or whatever, look up Jerry Fredrickson in Duluth, Minnesota.
Definitely. And if you listen to the podcast that I suggested in the beginning, he was actually the most recent podcast on there. So they talk about
his career
in the game.
Yep. Yeah. Chalk is cheap. Obviously, Nick Olson has never bought a cube of Kamui.
Oh, yeah. I had to think about that.
It is something, though, that chalk.
Yeah,
I mean, you can chalk up once every 10 shots and not miss you.
Yeah, my sponsor just sent me, my sponsor from Florida, Billiard Factory, Jacksonville. Definitely check them out if you're in the Florida area, especially if you need to buy like a pool table or anything like that. They do great work. But so they sent me a bunch of chalk, and they sent me Teom and Kamui. I've been using the Teom, and the Teom is, whew, it's good stuff. I really like it. I've also been using the Russian Magic chalk. Now I tried that out too, and that stuff is really, really, really good too. I've always been a triangle guy, but I think I'm going to be switching over to one of those full time. They're really nice. Yeah. So I guess basically this discussion means we really have nothing to talk about for a discussion topic, which is fine.
It does.
We're at about an hour right now, so that's it's a pretty good length for a podcast, especially since we have, you know, a little bit of stuff left. So we can go into our fan question of the week, and this one is going to be, what drove you to be a better player? How do you manage desire to get better? So basically, how did you manage your drive to become a better player? And this is actually a pretty good, if you guys don't mind, I'll take this away first, because this past weekend, or I guess the past week with the matchup, I realized that there are a lot of imperfections in my game. And I'll take this a step back even further. I think the human psyche really protects you from, I guess, looking at yourself critically. It always tries to protect you with defense mechanisms, blah, 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 blah. We always have that person on Facebook who talks way too much and knows way too much about everything. And you just kind of think to yourself, you know, how did this person get so educated on every single aspect of every single thing you could ever possibly dream of? They always know the answers. They always have, you know, the insights into all of these things. And they always know more than the experts, the people that have dedicated their entire lives to studying something and researching something. They're twice as smart as that person. There are a lot of people that really have this crazy ego about themselves where they cannot see any of their imperfections. And everybody has it to a degree, of course. I mean, that's the way the human brain works. But it really takes something like this past week, or there are a lot of aspects of my game that need a lot of work. And so I guess the way that I always see things, like, you know, small things like this here and there, are motivation to kind of work on those things. Originally, it was just the love of the game. Like, I couldn't play it enough. It was an addiction to the game, in the same way you have an addiction to anything else in life. It's just, you have to play it. You can't get enough. But as that goes on, that kind of wanes, or at least it has waned with me. And now I work on things when I feel like I need to work on things. And this past weekend, I have a lot of things that I really feel like I need to work on. So it could literally just be recording yourself in maybe a match that means something, or maybe going back and looking at, you know, if you've ever played on a stream table, going back and looking at that stream and kind of really dissecting your game. Try to find out where the voids are in your game, maybe the things that you need work on. And if you have a task to do, it might just, I mean, that's motivated me to actually start working on things in my game. So you can only see them if you actually see them. And I saw them a lot last week. So I guess that would be my answer to that, is you can't fix a problem you don't know exists. And the human mind is kind of in a situation where it tries to make it so you don't see these things. It always wants to make you seem perfect to yourself. So find ways to figure out imperfections in your game and try to work on them from there. Demetrius, do you want to go next?
That was a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'll chime in on this, and I'll keep it brief, because this is one of those topics that could either speak briefly, or I could go on for hours. So what I'll say is, as far as what you're saying, it's a very interesting, the fact that people that are incompetent don't realize it because they don't have the skills to recognize their own incompetence. And that's why people that are, it's actually, there's been a lot of studies on this. I forget what it's called, but people that aren't very good tend to overrate how good they are because they don't understand what they don't know. And oftentimes people that are experts don't recognize how good they are because they assume that everybody has that same understanding. It's very interesting how that plays out.
It's like 87% of people think they're above average driver.
That? Yeah. And I see this a lot where, I mean, it's just amazing how many people think that they know how everything about pool, and it's like, okay. But then, and then they have some weird stories about, you know, if I just had more time and if I just got to the table more, then I'd be the best. But it's because, you know, I have a job and, you know, that's why. But if I could just play every day, then nobody would beat me. Anyway, okay, so moving on. What I would say is that you have to make desire and motivation. You have to own that and make that part of the game. So the reason that people don't all do this is because when you start playing pool, there are a lot of things that are very naturally motivating, meaning you're getting better every day. You're learning new things every day, new shots every day. You're getting better. You can see improvement every day. You're beating players that used to beat you every day. People are praising you for your improvement. You're winning tournaments that are handicapped because you're moving up through the ranks. You're setting new high runs. I could go on and on, but the bottom line is there's a lot of what I call environmental motivation. Environmental motivation means you're not doing anything. It's just kind of happening naturally versus like internal motivation. It's the difference between, if you're on a bike, it's the difference between having a tailwind downhill versus having to pedal. And when you first start on this pool journey, it's all downhill with a tailwind. And so it's easy to think, I love riding bike. I never have to pedal. But what happens is things change and there are things that are very challenging. For example, plateaus in your game, or the fact that you haven't set a new high run in 5 years, or you haven't seen visible improvement, or you don't even know how to get better. And there's things that are very difficult that seem to be limiting you, whether it's certain shots that are just you can't seem to get better at, or the number of hours you can even play and compete. You know, you can only play one tournament a year because your work schedule, and how am I ever going to get better than this? And all these feelings that are like restricting, limiting, feeling stuck, those things are voiding your desire and motivation. And so all I can say is, again, I'm going to try to keep this really brief, but you have to understand that it is a part of the game to manage. So let's just say it's your fuel tank. When you buy a new car, if you go buy a brand new car, they fill up the gas tank. And for a while you can drive and you don't have to look at your gas tank because you've got fuel. But at some point you run out of fuel. And if you want to drive a car, it's your responsibility to watch the fuel gauge and find ways to put more fuel in it. And when you're a pool player, in the beginning of your pool journey for the first few years, you've got a lot of gas in the tank. And then as you start, you might think you'll never run out, but you will at some points because there are things that demotivate and things that are very challenging. And so you have to own that. This is part of, if you're a pool player, you're driving your pool career, you have to manage your gas tank. You have to own that. And I could speak more another time if somebody wants to email me directly or we have some conversations in the future, but there's a lot of things you can do to motivate yourself by having a plan to work around the challenges and obstacles in your way and finding things that motivate you and building that into your world so that you're not just hoping that something comes along and motivates you. And there's a lot of things you could do to actually overcome that, but it all starts with taking it on and being accountable for it and taking it on as a variable that you run instead of as a fix that's out of your control.
Yeah, that's really well said. And a little bit more in depth than what basically I was kind of saying is when I was a kid, it was super easy to motivate myself because I just wanted to play. There was, you know, you're always seeing improvement, all that good stuff. And then towards the end, you know, you got to find new ways to do it. And my way of doing it is probably seeing things to work on and having a checklist of things that I can improve on. Rob, what is your advice on this?
Well, for me, it was pretty simple. You know, got a room full of pool players. Nobody goes over to the guy that can't run three balls and asks him, how's he doing? You know, I mean, I didn't want to be that guy. I wanted to be the guy in the room where everybody came over and says, hey, what can I do to fix this? Or what can I, you know? So for me, it was personal pride. It was just integrity. It was accolades of my peers looking up to me. that was worth everything to me personally. I strove to be better at the game. And of course there was, yeah, sure. If you win some money, you go to a big tournament. That's nice too. But it was more a respect thing that drove me. My desire was to be respected for something, you know, not just your job. For me, I gained respect in my occupation, by having the people I do work for tell me that was a nice job. Where pool was kind of the same way. It was more internal, an internal feeling. And I got to say one thing about players as they're coming up. What I've seen is really a roadblock to them becoming better, easier, and not having to really, really work at it so hard. I never felt that I worked at my game hard at all. It came more natural with the desire. But if you can, and Denny touched on this, if you can understand where your limitations are in your game, then you're not going to say, okay, gee, all I got to do is go three rails right here to get shape on that ball. And there's four balls in the way. Okay. But you're just saying, no, that's the way I want to do it, because you're in charge. You're the shooter. And I think when you really take a look at, well, yeah, you can do it that way, but you're going to make that shot through all them balls 1 out of 10 times. There's got to be an easier way. And I think, so understanding where you're at, and I think you need somebody else to do that. Right? I mean, you need somebody else to tell you where you're at, because you have nothing to compare to where your skills are at. So doing a boot camp. I just think those types of ideas, even if it's just one day, that's going to let you know where you're at when you're done with it. So that's where I go with desire. I'd say, you know, you either kind of got it or you don't. Otherwise, you got to find a particular motivating factor out there, and it's different for everybody. So.
Yeah, that's definitely good advice too. For you know, just do a boot camp. Obviously, Demetrius, you can talk about this. You know, either today or in the future, as far as when you, well, I'm sure you'll do it for your coach's corner that you're going to do pretty soon. But yeah, I definitely, that would solve the problem that I had of, you know, watch a video of yourself, you know, in high pressure situations, just yep. Going and working with somebody all day long, Demetrius, and having him, you know, kind of, you know, dissect your game and be able to pick it apart and, you know, let everybody know individually, you know, where their game needs work, how they can improve, and all that good stuff. That's definitely an option worth looking into as well if you're able to financially swing it in these times.
Well, you ever know these great players that laugh after they miss or make a mistake? Really good players that just laugh.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt about it, guys. I mean, anybody. That's why I do what I do, is because I know personally many, many players that have been. I had a guy here last week from California that says he hasn't gotten better at pool in 40 years. And so part of what we did was not on the table, because as long as he believes that he knows everything he can learn about pool and this is just as good as he could get, as long as that's the story and the narrative he's telling himself, it's hard to get better if that's what you believe. And so part of the problem is he's been beaten down by 40 years of plateau. But anyway, I'm digressing. The point is that it's hard to be motivated when you feel like you're not going to get any better and there's nothing more you can do. And so, yes, part of what I do at a boot camp, I love doing this, is taking somebody and helping them identify what is keeping them stuck, showing it to them, because they can't see it. They think they know everything about pool because they've been students of the game for 30 years or 40 years. And they think they know everything there is about to know about pool, but that's because you don't know what you don't know. And I can show it, and I show them the game through my eyes, and I show them their game through my eyes. And it's not, you know, and then as they can see it, and I found some really cool ways to help them see it. And then I can show them how to bridge the gap and how to start making progress again. And when they leave here, not only do they have an idea of where they need to get better and what they can work on, but they have a vision of where they could be and how they can actually get there. And it's, I'll tell you what, that's extremely motivating. So yes, it's a lot of fun.
For sure.
That was a good question by whoever wrote that in.
Yeah, I agree.
That question.
So, Demetrius, we can go into your coach's corner now, which is basically your corner of the podcast to talk about whatever you want. So anybody who's listening for the first time, this is basically Demetrius's opportunity to chat about whatever he wants to chat about. So take it away, Demetrius.
Sounds great. Thanks, Nate. Welcome to another Coach's Corner. Yes, part of my podcast, or part of our podcast, where I get to help you get your game to the next level. Anybody that has questions can reach out to me at info@mnpoolbootcamp.com, or you can check out my website. I am running 3-day pool boot camps for anybody in the country, anybody that wants to fly into Minnesota, work with me for 3 days, go home a different player. And so this week, keep it real short and simple. I just wanted to talk about the some of the beliefs that we have about pool. And you know, I look at it as what we believe can either be helpful and useful and constructive, or it can be, you know, destructive or limiting. And there's a lot of times when people think about, they try to figure out what's true or what's right. And some of these things don't really have necessarily, they're all debatable topics. And I'll give you guys some examples. But instead of trying to think about what's right or what's true, think about it in the sense, if you want to get better at pool, I'm just assuming you guys want to get better at pool. I want to get better at pool. So I think about it in the sense of what is going to help me get better at pool. I'll just believe that. Why would I want to believe something that's going to demotivate me or you know, whatever? So one example that I get of this all the time is this debate between, is pool hard work or talent? This idea of talent. Let's talk about the idea of talent. How much does talent required to be at the highest levels of pool? So clearly you have to have some kind of talent, because if you're blind and you don't have arms, it's going to be very, very difficult to run tables. So there are physical requisites to play high-level pool. And clearly you have to put in a lot of work, because nobody was born with the ability to play great elite championship-level pool. So somewhere, it's not 100% talent. It's not 100% hard work. It's somewhere in the middle. But there's a big debate, and a lot of people really believe in this idea of talent, and they really make the argument that guys like Josh Filler, yeah, he's worked hard and everything, but some people just have it. And the problem I have with that is that we don't know. Like, nobody's going to know. Nobody gets to be right here. It just gets to be, is it useful? Like, let's take a look at what happens when you believe in talent. When you believe in talent, then it's easy to believe that maybe you're one of the people that just didn't get it, which means that what's the point of trying to develop your game? And you're just, you know, you're lowering your beliefs about what you can do, and you're lowering the motivation you have to put in and try to develop what you have. And you can sit there and make an argument that, well, I'm trying to be realistic so I don't, you know, get heartbroken because I can't do what I want to do. And we can sit here and talk about that, spirals into a conversation about, you know, are we better off setting goals aggressively and getting back, you know, shooting for the stars and hitting the moon, or are we better off trying to hedge and set low goals so that we don't have any kind of disappointment? I mean, I don't even want to go into it, but the point is, for me, I'm a believe in hard work kind of guy. I like to just say, give me eyes and give me a set of eyes that open and a pair of hands that can move a cue stick, and it's all hard work and it's all on me. Now, I might be wrong. Maybe it's not all hard work. Maybe I was, you know, not dealt a talent card, but I'll just assume and choose to believe that it's all hard work, because when I believe that, then I look in the mirror and I go put in a lot of hard work. And guess what? Sometimes I learn how to do stuff that I might not have ever figured out how to do if I just believed I wasn't capable of it. So that's one example, is the whole talent versus hard work. Another example of a belief that people might choose is, how much do you really need to be playing pool to play great pool? So some people believe you have to put in a lot of hours every day to get better, or a lot of hours every day to play your best. And other players might believe that they can just go 6 months without picking up a cue and then play well. And so this one, I choose what I believe changes depending on my situation. So if I'm in a spot where I can put in time every day in a pool table, well, then I will choose to believe that putting in time every day in a pool table helps me get to the next level. And I can easily defend that. It makes perfect sense. You know, you put in hours, you work on stuff, you get more comfortable, you develop, you, all these things. So that's what I tell myself to motivate myself to practice daily. But let's just suppose that I have a month where, you know, there's a lot going on in my life and I can't play a lot, but then I have to go play a tournament. Then if I sat there and told myself that, well, I haven't been playing every day for the last month, which means I'm going to play bad and I'm not going to be prepared. And I'm just, you know, I need to hit balls for 2 weeks every day for 5 hours in order to get back in stroke. Like, that belief is not going to help me compete. It's just not going to help me feel confident, deliver my best. So I shift what I believe. And I say, actually, I believe I'm the kind of guy that I can grab my cue the night before a tournament, put in a 3-hour session, spar with somebody for 3 hours on a tight pocketed table. And you know what? I might make a mistake once, but I'll stumble through a tough match, pull it out and catch a gear and I'll be fine. And so if I have the opportunity to prepare, then I believe in preparation. And if I don't have the opportunity to prepare, then I'm going to choose to believe in my ability to, you know, find my game, you know, because of all the hours I've put into my life. And so the point is, these are just two random examples. The point is, I am not the least bit interested in what's correct or true or what is right. I'm interested in what's going to help me be motivated and play my best. And yes, if there is an answer, you know, if the truth is that putting in hours every day, of course it's important to know that, because then you can try to build your life and motivate yourself to practice. So I'm not saying that there's no value in any you know, real reality or truth. But what I am saying is that we have to be very, very careful of the ideas that we choose to believe. And when you're when there's ideas that can't be right or wrong, they're just kind of opinion or debatable stuff, I would encourage you guys to look at it from a lens of not what's right or true, but what is going to help you guys hit your goals and get where you want to be. So that's it. If you guys have questions, comments, email me at info@mnpoolbootcamp.com. Come check in and help get their game to the next level. We're going to keep training. And actually, there's almost not a better time. So, all right. Thank you, guys.
Yeah. So I guess that brings another episode to a close. We are doing this on the 5th of May. So I guess you will not be hearing this until probably at least the 7th, because like I said, I still have some finals that I got to take care of. But I did want to get this recorded, because if we didn't get it recorded today, we weren't going to be able to get it recorded until the weekend. So wanted to make sure that we at least got it recorded, and gives me the opportunity to get it out this week. So I thank you guys again for joining me. And anybody out there who's made it through to this point and you're a new listener, we hope that we can keep you around. Reach out at any time, of course, on our Facebook page, or, you know, to me specifically, or to any of the hosts on here with your suggestions. We're always open to changing the format of the podcast so that people like it more. So, you know, anything that you can think of, reach out at any time. And other than that, Rob, Demetrius, thank you for joining me again.
Thanks, guys. Have a good week. Talk to you soon.
Oh, we lost Rob, so I guess he didn't want to say bye to everybody. All right. See you later, Demetrius.
Take care.